This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. My name is Cara. I work at the Women's Resource Centre. So I suppose I just wanted to really follow up on Maddie's presentation to give you a little bit of an insight into some of the things that we found when we were engaging in a mapping exercise of the women's sector earlier this year. So I wanted to talk today in light of that about a number of different things. Maddie's mentioned it, but I thought it was really useful to actually start by looking at the 2008 CEDAW examination of the UK government. I think this is a really useful framework for understanding some of the issues that we're discussing today. It places women's work and the work that we're all doing within a human rights framework, and I think some of that language and some of those arguments are very empowering for us. Also, at its core, it talks about equality for women, non-discrimination, and it places an onus on governments to act. Within that framework, we'll look at three things that were picked up by the committee and recommended to the UK government last year, which I think are very, very relevant at the moment to women's organisations' experiences. Those three things are funding to women's organisations, the misapplication or application of the gender equality duty, and the impact of commissioning frameworks for women's organisations, particularly, as Maddie's pointed out, some of those organisations at the very small and specialised end of the spectrum. After setting a bit of the context there and talking about some of the things that were revealed through the piece of research that we did earlier this year, I wanted to then focus on what next beyond 2009. And talk about three kind of aspects to an approach that we're certainly adopting at WRC and hearing from our members that may provide a little more light to this very bleak picture, as has been pointed out. So the three things that I'll be looking at are partnership working, building relationships and influencing, and demonstrating value and worth. So for those of you who are not familiar with this, and I know some of you are because you attended the examination last year, middle of last year, the UK government reported to the United Nations to the committee to eliminate discrimination against women. And as a result of that, the committee produced quite an interesting report which commended some of the government's initiatives on its efforts to eliminate inequality and advance equality for women, but also made a number of recommendations for urgent action. One of the things that the committee noted was that changes in the way that women's organisations are funded, primarily a shift from grant funding to commissioning, was having very detrimental effects on women's organisations. Equally, that the gender-neutral interpretation of the gender equality duty was negatively impacting on funding to women's organisations, and importantly, the provision and threats to women-only services. And that despite some temporary measures to fund women's organisations, which I'll speak about a little bit later, that the committee noticed with great concern the impending closure of many women's organisations. So from those recommendations, we started a piece of research which attempted to map, in terms of the financial sustainability, women's organisations over a three-year period from 2004 to 2007. From that research, we identified 1,348 women's organisations. Over a quarter of those were delivering support services to women who'd experienced violence. And three quarters of those organisations were working in the area of domestic violence. However, the definition that we used of violence against women, which is the one adopted by the UN, includes a range of other forms of violence against women. And sometimes women's organisations are working across these areas. What we discovered is that the East Midlands had the highest proportion of organisations working to address violence against women, and London as a region had the highest number of organisations working to address violence against women, but these organisations represented 13% of the organisations in this region. We found that women's organisations with an annual income of £10,000 per year or less represented 16% of all the women's organisations we looked at. And organisations with an income of £1 million or more made up 6%, but accounted for half of all the income. So you're seeing a fairly large gap emerging there. Organisations with an income of between £10,000 and £100,000 were more likely to experience high income volatility. This was just quite an interesting point to note, and you may have had experiences of this yourself within your own organisation, very high fluctuations in income year on year. So the definition of high income volatility, which is adopted by NCVO in the Civil Almanac last year, was that organisations that have had a high change of income, so over 20% in one direction in one year, and then a change of income 20% in the opposite direction within the next year. So you can, it begins to emerge a fairly stark picture in terms of huge fluctuations in income. It's already been stated, but I think it's worth mentioning again that really we're talking about organisations who are most vulnerable at the very small specialised end of the spectrum. So Income did a report last year that said 50% of specialist black, Asian, minority ethnic violence against women's organisations had actually closed in the five-year period that they conducted their research. Map of Gaps, which has just been mentioned, found that one in four local authorities had no specialist service provision for women whatsoever. And that, as Maddie pointed out, new services were developing in statutory and criminal-based responses rather than through women's sector services. I just wanted to link this now to the CEDAW committee recommendations of 2008. And there is a specific recommendation and request that the UK government provide increased and sustained funding to women's organisations, and to actually include in the next report to the CEDAW committee information on exactly, setting out exactly how they plan to, they have funded women's organisations. As highlighted in the Civil Society Almanac last year, there's a trend from grant aid towards contracts and commissioning. As mentioned, this has been, in our experience, anecdotally, very detrimental for women's organisations, despite guidance that has been produced on intelligent commissioning. And what we're seeing as a result of that is that big, rather than small, national rather than local women's organisations are picking up contracts for services. And what we're seeing is that that's enabled a growth of super providers, larger organisations, sometimes private companies, that are well equipped to win the contracts but not necessarily well equipped to develop services locally. So research conducted by WRC in 2007 found that seven independent refuges run by women's organisations had been taken over by housing associations since the introduction of competitive tendering. We also discovered that 66% of women's income actually comes from local authorities through supporting people's contracts or other local authority funding, which means that the reliance on local funding leaves organisations very vulnerable to changes in funding frameworks or to being decommissioned. We did a case study earlier this year of a women's project in Liverpool who said, "We don't know what will happen after 2011. If Liverpool Council decided to stop funding us, that would be the end, I think." To date, no research has been done to determine the full impact of competitive tendering on the women's sector, although we know that this is having very damaging effects. There's a CEDAW recommendation from last year that the UK government conduct an impact assessment of these commissioning frameworks on funding to women's organisations. The second piece of recommendation that I wanted to pick up was about the gender equality duty. And we've discovered that despite the introduction of this piece of legislation, women's organisations have been challenged about their women-only status. In a rape crisis study that Women's Resource Centre conducted last year, 43% of women's organisations were challenged by funders about their women-only status. Although it being a legal requirement for local authorities to consider the different impacts of funding decisions on women and men, but are constantly reinterpreting the gender equality duty in a gender-neutral way. We've found that this meant that women's organisations are just being excluded from tendering because commissioners want to contract with a single service provider delivering a generic service but with no gender analysis. So that means that commissioning is not meeting the needs of women survivors of war, failing women, and also failing under domestic and international legal obligations. The CEDAW committee recommended in July 2008 that the UK government ensure that the interpretation and application of the gender equality duty does not negatively impact on the provision of women-only services or restrict the activities of women's organisations. So I just wanted to give a bit of a snapshot. It was mentioned that there is some political will now, and that's on the basis, I think, of a lot of sustained campaigning by women's organisations. I've just listed here some of the recent announcements for sometimes pilot funding, sometimes 1 or 2 year funding that have come from various government departments. For example, Miriam Eagle announcing funding for one-stop shops for women's services based on the Causton report in February this year. The Hardship Fund, which was the source of a little bit of controversy at the beginning of this week, which was set up primarily to deliver services to the most vulnerable groups through the recession. Government Equalities Office Emergency Fund for Rape Crisis Centre, which was announced by Harriet Harman in August. The Greater London Authority funding announced by Boris Johnson, which was about increased funding for RASAC and a new rape crisis centre in London. Last week, the Home Office announcing funding for a no-recourse pilot to support women and the services that provide them. And also the City Parochial Esme Furban and Rosa Fund, which will be announced next month, which looks at funding for women's organisations around female genital mutilation. Now, some of these initiatives are great and, as I say, are the result of a lot of sustained campaigning by women's groups and driven out of need, but they need to be part of a joined-up strategy with ring-fenced funding attached. So beyond this fairly bleak situation, what do we have to look forward to and how could we work differently? There are a couple of different things that I wanted to point out. One is the partnership working model, which is also fraught with difficulty, but it offers us some hope. The option to diversify funding base and to look at aspects like social enterprise. Demonstration of value and worth. I'm going to talk briefly about a project that we're working on with the New Economics Foundation about social return on investment. And, of course, lobbying and building relationship with commissioners and policymakers. So some current partnership working. In line with the Ministry of Justice funding that was announced by Maria Eagle, one of the successful partnership groups, Brighton Women's Partnership. We've been working alongside various organisations to support them with this bid. And it's about 5 organisations in Brighton working locally to provide holistic services to women offenders, ex-offenders and those at risk of offending. Social Return on Investment Project is a project that we're working on with 5 organisations in London. So Oceana Network, Somali Women's Association, Heba Women's Project and Women and Girls Network. This is a 2-year research project to demonstrate the social outcomes, the many and varied social outcomes delivered by these critical services that accrue to individual women, families and their communities. And that's a partnership with New Economics Foundation. And, of course, Wednesday last week, the government announced a 3-month pilot scheme for women with no recourse and the services that support them in response to a range of different lobbying activities by the No Recourse campaign group. Campaign groups met with senior Home Office officials in May, and after this meeting, the Home Office withdrew the proposal for further consideration based on concerns identified by these groups. So the pilot scheme shows some signs of improvement. For example, some of the payments to refuge providers have increased from 25 days to 40 days. There's an increase in the actual amounts payable and an agreement that payments for refuge providers will be made upfront rather than backdated payments. However, it's an imperfect solution and the No Recourse campaign group still have significant concerns that have not been picked up. Namely, that the pilot will only apply to those on spousal visas and does not include a cohort of women, including students, overstayers, asylum-seeking women, and those on other visas. This is actually a human rights issue. It's not an immigration issue. And the UK government is in breach of its international obligations to protect women from violence and destitution in this country, irregardless of their immigration status. This is a pilot and there are concerns that there is no commitment to a longer-term, permanent, humane solution. And this funding is woefully inadequate. And we actually need an exemption or removal of the no-recourse ruling in order to actually resolve this and to make any real difference in women's lives. And that's it for me. Thank you very much. Thank you.